Hello, welcome to your meditation practice as part of the Open Heart Project. My name is Susan Piver. If you're just joining, welcome. I'm founder of the Open Heart Project. And it is my honor to offer you this short talk on the second of the six paramitas. And I'll explain what that is in a moment if you're just joining. And then we'll sit together in meditation for about 10 minutes. The six paramitas, and again, this is the second in this series of six videos, are sometimes translated as the six perfections or the six transcendent actions. These six actions have the power to transport us to the other shore, the shore that we long to arrive at, the shore of decency, sanity, kindness, humanity, care for all beings. That's the world we want to live in. And it can often seem like that is impossible because the world we do live in so often lacks those qualities. That's kind of an understatement. So I sometimes despair. Well, how are we going to get there? What can possibly help heal this world? All of us, not just me. If I just get to the other shore by myself, I'm going to be kind of lonely. I want you to come too. How do we all get there? There may be policies, strategies, theories, all sorts of things, and some of them seem quite brilliant, but none of them seem to have the power to actually take us there like the six paramitas do. That's my experience of the six paramitas. You must have your own experience of them. And as always, don't take my word for anything. Don't take anyone's word for anything. You must figure it out yourself. Luckily, there are extraordinary teachings to help us on our journey to understand what's real and what's true. But for better and for worse, no one can tell you what's real and what's true. You have to figure it out. And P.S., if anyone tries to tell you this is real, this is true, yeah. Thank you. See ya. I don't say that lightly. Though there are many great teachers, great teachings, you still have to figure it out yourself. So the paramitas, there are six, as mentioned, start with generosity, which we talked about 2 weeks ago. And there'll be a link in here if you want to watch that or rewatch that, but you don't have to, you can jump in right here. So the six paramitas are generosity, 2 weeks ago, discipline, today's topic, patience, exertion, meditative absorption, and wisdom. The six paramitas have an interesting rhythm. They move from something that is gentle and spacious and all accommodating, like generosity, which is followed by something, in this case, discipline, that is sharp and fierce and one-pointed. In 2 weeks, we'll talk about patience, the third of the six paramitas, which again opens the space, softens us, and following that is exertion, like you got to do it. Get on your horse and ride. So all the six paramitas move in this rhythm of open and soft and fierce and one-pointed. And that's important because open and soft, generosity, for example, on its own can be kind of sappy or unskillful. But when you bring in discipline, your generosity can be effective. By the same token, discipline, working hard, sticking to your commitments, we'll explore what discipline means more thoroughly in a moment, without generosity is kind of the path of the hard ass, you could say. So generosity needs discipline. Discipline needs generosity. Generosity and discipline need patience, and so on and so forth. So though they are six separate gestures, they form a mandala, a whole, that is quite beautiful. And I say that from the bottom of my heart. I've been contemplating and studying and attempting to deploy the six paramitas for decades. And at no point have I ever thought, okay, got it. It just doesn't seem to work that way. They mean something far deeper than what I can comprehend through study or contemplation although study and contemplation are very important, but their true meaning, because they are transcendent actions, not conventional actions, their true meaning is always just beyond conventional thought, which to me makes them trustworthy. So though our relationship to each of the six paramitas and the six as a whole can deepen continuously and will, if you invest in them with your heart and mind, you never get to the destination. I don't know who designed this, but that's how it seems to work. So generosity, as mentioned 2 weeks ago, is something that occurs naturally when you are connected to your own richness. And you may have lots of stuff in the bank that counts as your richness. Good for you. You may have great qualities, a tremendously deep character, a powerful position at work, a beloved position in your own home, interest in things that are interest worthy. You may know a lot about this subject or that. You may be the world's most lovely and wonderful person, which I actually think you are. Sometimes, at least. Those are your riches. And when you remain connected to those things, like, yeah, I got those things, then generosity is no problem. No problem. I have so much. What do you need? Okay, let me look through here. Oh, got it. Let me offer it to you. So it all begins with remembering how rich you are. And even if you are in the most humble of circumstances and experiencing a period of lack, my heart goes out to you. And at the same time, there is something in your environment, in your heart, that qualifies as richness. So examine, don't take my word for it. Generosity can arise in one of three forms, countless forms, but the Buddha Dharma suggests three main categories of generosity. Giving material goods, you need some money, you're cold, you need a sweater, got it. Let me try to offer you something if I can, if I can. Second, offering the gift of Dharma, which means knowledge and truth. You help people who want that help, you don't try to foist it on them, to help them see their own wisdom more clearly. That's one way of looking at giving the gift of Dharma. Not what I know, because it only doesn't really matter what I know. What matters is what you know. And how can I help you develop confidence in that knowing? And then the third form of generosity, and then we'll move on to discipline, is giving the gift of fearlessness, which is quite important. So instead of discouraging people because we're afraid, we could encourage people in a skillful way to do what matters to them. So often we get the message, oh, don't do that, don't try that, that's too scary. And that can be really good advice, and nobody should be silly. But at the same time, we can overuse those arguments of, who are you to try that? And life is not going to work out if you do this. And okay, maybe that's true. But if we start with discouragement, we're not going to get very far. And we can give the gift of fearlessness by skillfully encouraging people to remember what's important to them. Those are good gifts. Now, discipline, the second paramita, means so many things. And often, at least when I think of discipline, or I know when people talk about, I wish I was more disciplined and so on, it's said with a lot of aggression towards oneself. I suck is the underlying message. Why can't I be more disciplined? Why can't I stick to my commitments, accomplish more, get up at 5:30 and do this and that for hours before I go to work? Yeah, I do those things all the time. My journal's filled with ideal schedules for Susan Piper's life. So good. If you can be disciplined about those things, that's no small thing. That's fantastic. But often discipline is interpreted as some sort of willful forcing of oneself to do things that one would rather not do, or that one thinks one should do. Okay, we all got to do things we'd rather not do, and we all know about things we should do, and I'm not saying those things are fake, they're real. But here, discipline doesn't mean like twisting your own arm and making yourself do things. Interestingly, to me. In Buddhism, discipline is considered synonymous with joy, not with pain. And I think about that a lot because I'm like, well, this doesn't feel very joyful all the time. However, when I do honor my commitments to myself and to my life and to my loved ones, whatever those commitments might be, when I can do that with a sense of delight rather than shoulding, it is quite joyful. When I get to the end of such a day, I feel so happy. I did the things that I want to do to honor my life. Oh, yay. That does make one happy, no question. But it's also considered joyful because in this version of discipline, the primary discipline is to be in your experience as it arises with simplicity and wakefulness and presence of mind. That's the discipline that we seek to cultivate and that we learn in our meditation practice, which we'll get to shortly. But there's a discipline of not getting too excited when things go well, although one should take pleasure in those things, and not becoming too discouraged when things don't go well, although things can be discouraging. But to not let oneself slip too far in either direction, not to remain like a zombie-like person who considers good things and bad things to be equal, but to remain present with what's happening now. So a little example from my own life is when I first started writing books, I could not help but look at my reviews on Amazon. Well, that was a very bad idea. And I don't do that anymore. But if you've written a review of one of my books, I'm so grateful. Thank you. Because I found that if someone gave me a good review, I was like, oh, I'm the bomb, y'all. Sometimes I am, but you know, that's not always true, certainly. But I would get very excited, like my ship's coming in, my dreams are coming true. The future, you know, is so bright, I gotta wear shades, to quote an 80s band from Austin, Texas. Okay, that's nice and enjoyable. But always, at some point, whether it was in a minute or a year, there would be some kind of a, well, maybe not. So didn't want to go there anymore. And then, of course, when I saw a bad review, oh my God, I would just collapse in a heap and think, not just, oh, that hurts, because it does. That's not weird. But I would then start to spin out and think, my life's not going anywhere. I'm a failure. Why do I do any of these things? Nobody is interested in what I'm blah, 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 blah. And then I would have to find some way to pick myself up. So at some point, I decided I'm not going on that ride anymore because this and this, both poles, lead to Palookaville. And I'd rather just not go on the ride, as I say, and stay here. Stay here. So that's the primary discipline. Stay here. When things are going well, yay, that's easy to be disciplined. When things are going poorly, not so easy. Understandable. But we can still remain fierce and brave and try to lean into our experience in all cases with one very important caveat, if trauma is involved, because that's a different category. So I just don't want anyone who is experiencing trauma, acute or chronic, to think, oh, Buddhist lady said I need to stay with things because that's what is meant by discipline. No, maybe, but you are the boss of you, and trauma is just more complicated than that. So I know people think meditation is good for everything all the time, but I am not one of those people. It is not good for everything all the time. So be prudent. To maintain such discipline, the discipline of remaining present to your actual experience, it's very useful, necessary perhaps, to develop some kind of relationship with simplicity. So if I read a bad review, I made it very complicated by spinning out, with hurt feelings. Why? Because I'm a person. Similarly, if someone writes, oh, she's great, I spin out with all sorts of other kind of dreams because I'm a person. So I add something to both situations. I add my own thoughts, my hopes, my fears, and so on because I'm a person. But simplicity means not adding anything. Very difficult, very difficult. But in our practice, that is actually what we are practicing. And when we get to our meditation, you will see that or remember that if you are already a meditator. We're practicing letting go of everything but the breath. The breath is not the main objective in meditation. Oh, during meditation it is, but we practice with the breath so that when we go into our lives, we can be with that. So I practice with my breath as a stand-in for my whole life. So I've cultivated this quality of discipline, which here means coming back to the breath so that when I go into my world and something distracts me, like a bad Amazon review or a good Amazon review, these are very small examples, I can let go of that and come back to right now, to you, to myself, to this experience. So I practice with the breath, not to be good at being with the breath, but to be good at being with my life. That is the real discipline. And so you already know how to do it, because when you meditate or when you do meditate, if this is your first time and you become distracted, you notice that, you let go, and you come back. That is the sum total of what is meant by discipline. Can you come back? And the answer is, of course, yes. You may be away again, but you can come back then too. So you got this. So just as there were three sort of categories of generosity for the paramita of discipline, there are also three categories. And the first category of discipline is called binding oneself. And what you bind yourself to is what we were just talking about right now. I'm binding myself to the best of my ability to right now. And when I spin out, I come back. I pay attention to what I'm doing. And even could consider that whatever it is that I am doing could be considered my spiritual practice. So when I do my meditation, that seems clear. That's a spiritual practice. But when I make a cup of coffee and drink it, that can be a practice too. If I pay attention, if I let myself become absorbed, if I synchronize my mind and body and actions to all be in the same place, that is a form of discipline. I'm going to pay attention to what I'm doing. Not like with the kind of sense of gripping it, but with a sense of flowing into it and with it and not spacing out. It's the ultimate discipline is the synchronization of body and mind, because often they're going in two different directions. Your body lies down to sleep, but your mind thinks of all your emails, or, you know, you want to read a book, but your mind wants to read a book, but your body falls asleep. They're often going in two different directions. And discipline means bringing them back, synchronizing them. So when we're making a cup of coffee, for example, I feel what my body's doing. I may sense I like coffee. I can't wait to drink it. And then when I drink it, I actually taste it. And then when I put the cup down, I don't slam it down. I place it down. And then I wash it at some point, dry it, put it away. So there's a sense of properness, doing things properly, which doesn't mean being a goody-goody. It just means when I start something, I finish it. My dear departed father, who died in 2012, missing every single moment, had a motto for his life that he wanted to pass on to his children. This is the most important thing, my children, that you should know how to do. Cool. What's that, Dad? Finish the job. Finish the job. It's not like be a good person or you give something back to the world, although he was a really good person and he gave a hell of a lot back to the world. But his view was, if you start something, finish it. And that to me is a really beautiful and sometimes difficult example of what it means to be disciplined. You can't know how things are going to end. So you start, everybody starts things and then it's like, no, I'm not going to do it. But that's fine. You can still finish the job by saying, I have decided to discontinue this action. This job is complete. So there's a sense of attention in the beginning, the middle, and the end. And if you're anything like myself and basically everyone, we depart the beginning, the middle, and the end by getting absorbed in hope for how it could work out and fears about how it might disappoint. Fine. You can be with those things too. You can be with your hope, be with your fear. That's still considered binding. You have bound yourself to your experience. Very powerful. The second category of discipline is called gathering virtuous dharmas, which means you keep trying, certainly, but you also keep paying attention to your experience. Oh, I did some good binding today, or I sucked at binding today. What actually is meant by binding oneself? What actually is meant by discipline? Who can teach me this? I could read about it. I could listen to people talk about it. I could contemplate it and journal about it. Gathering virtuous dharmas has the sense of I continue to deepen my understanding and my experience of what it means to be disciplined, of what it means to be a human, of what it means to love, all the things. So that's an important discipline because it's easy to think, well, it didn't work out, so I'm not going to think about it again, or I'm terrible at it, I give up. Maybe you're terrible at it, maybe you shouldn't give up. But usually that's a kind of, I'm too afraid to go forward. So to continue to gather as virtuous dharmas, I could continue to study my experience as it unfolds in whatever direction it goes in. I remain bound to my experience. And I continue to work to understand it more thoroughly. And the third form of discipline is called benefiting sentient beings. So this obviously is an extremely important discipline and brings with it the sense that, yes, I'm bound to my experience and I'm attempting to learn and deepen my understanding of my experience and of life itself, but I'm also here for you. I would like to help. I would like what I have bound myself to and the virtuous dharmas that I've gathered to be a benefit to you too. So this is a very potent discipline. It really does not require much explanation of when you see something or someone that needs help and you can offer help, you do. Very important. I think it seems obvious. So you can't help everyone. And sometimes you can't help anyone. Okay, that's fine. You can help yourself. That counts as benefiting sentient beings. The idea here is that you are willing and able to spend time in your life for the benefit of others, skillfully. Now, this can be a hard message to hear because many of us hear it, especially women, I would say, as you need to put yourself second. And that is not what is meant by benefiting sentient beings at all. Self-care is essential because then you have something to offer others. But to think this means I don't count is wrong view. It's just more nuanced and complicated than that. Yes, other people are as important and sometimes more important than you or me, shockingly. That doesn't mean I abandon myself. Because I bound myself to my experience, I am gathering virtuous dharmas to understand that experience better, and then I can be of benefit in a more skillful way. So I hope this is interesting. I hope it's useful. Do let me know. I'd love to hear from you. You can let me know in comments. That would be fabulous. And if you have any questions or anything, that would be fabulous too. So let's practice. Begin your practice by establishing your posture. which means primarily to sit up straight, but not stiff. And when you sit up straight, there's more of a likelihood that you will experience your own elegance, your own grace, your own beauty. The legs can be crossed loosely in front of you, or if you're in a chair, the feet can be flat on the floor. It's also fine to kneel. Basically, sit comfortably and upright. Let the belly soften, the heart and lungs, and the throat. Feel the strength of your back body and the softness of your front body. And this strength and softness are inseparable, just like your back and front. Let the shoulders relax. The mouth is closed, but the lips and teeth can be slightly parted. The breath is natural in and out through the nose, meaning no breathing technique, just regular breathing, which you already are quite expert at. The eyes are open, since we are practicing being awake. And the gaze is cast down to a spot in front, somewhere that feels comfortable, given the distance of your screen, up to about 6 feet or 2.5 meters. And let there be a sense of receiving through the eyes rather than targeting through the eyes. Just let what's in your visual field come to you. Let the eyes be very soft. And let the forehead relax. Now let your attention rest on the breath, which means feel the body breathe rather than observe the body breathe. It's just very simple. You're feeling the gentle expansion on the inhale and the letting go on the exhale. The next inhale just happens, so come in with that and flow out. The following exhale, repeat, breathing in and out. Your mind will continue to make thoughts, which is fine, no problem, not a big deal. Just let that happen. There's no effort to clear the mind of thought or think good thoughts. Just let it be as it is. Most of your thoughts will come and go without you having to do anything. They won't really distract you from your breath. However, should you notice that you've become so distracted by thought that you've forgotten about your breath, that's very good. So now you know, oh, I'm not meditating anymore. I'm thinking. So you label that moment thinking. You don't just shove it away. You notice it. I'm thinking. Then let go. It doesn't matter what the content is. Important, trivial, vicious, beautiful, dull. Just let go. Gently come back to this breath and begin again, feeling the body breathe. This is our practice, and we'll sit together in silence for a little bit more until you hear the bell. Thank you so much for your practice. Thank you for practicing with me. And thank you for practicing together. And I'll see you in 2 weeks with the third Paramita, patience.